version number 24731, Real 8.
Mr. Emery, Real 8. We're talking about this German jet aircraft attack on your headquarters billets in a farm. And you were saying that someone was buried.
Well, it was at the barn door was off its roller, where it was lying on the floor, and Fred was partly underneath his. But anyway, we lifted the door up and dragged him out. He was a bit bruised and battered, and most uncomplimentary about German pilots, actually. But apparently, nothing wrong with him. And that was that, really. That was he never came back, the pilot, the third time to see what he'd done. He was gone. But I do remember watching these two bombs, and I'm sure they had both of them had my name on it, because he wasn't all that high up, you know, he wasn't up thousands of feet, he was only about 500 or 600 feet, I suppose. You could see every detail about him, yeah. Then we went down from there, we moved down to Sittard, which was a bit further down somewhere. That was in right on the German borders, really. I don't know what the guns would say, RHQ was freezing, the snow everywhere, frozen solid on the roads and things like that. I can't remember much about that. I knew we had to tune in to a radio station. We were, Billy and I were stationed outside from where RHQ was, in some, I don't know, it was a doctor's house. The room, the basement room we had, was full of glass files and whatnot else there all around it, but hey, we were there. We had to tune in to this radio on to give us a frequency. We tuned in that. We had to answer a call sign in the morning at 9 o'clock or whenever it was, and a call sign at night. So we did this, got in strength 5, yeah, I don't know, whatever it was, and he said, all right, out, and forget it, 9 o'clock at night, do exactly the same. This went on for 2 days.
And what radio station was it? What?
We don't know. It was an American radio station. All we had to do was, what it was for, I don't know. After 2 days, everywhere we got in, morning and night, nobody come and ask. We were down there isolated. On eventually, up turned a signal officer with a couple of Americans, and said, how's that man been in touch with this? I said, we've been in every day, sir, twice a day. Oh, no, you haven't. He's not receiving you anyway. I said, well, anyway, they all come down at 9 o'clock at night and went through the same procedure, got a strength 5, and they all disappeared, or whatever it was. But whoever it was we were talking to, it wasn't the radio station we were supposed to be. But it intrigued the Americans, so whatever it was all about, I don't know. But and what it was for, I don't know. As I say, a lot of things went on that I didn't. It all seemed double dutch to me. I sometimes wonder what it was all about, if you want to know. So, as I said, we used to do counter mortar fire the Germans given any trouble.
Tell me about that.
Well,
I mean, you wouldn't be doing that.
I wouldn't know, but the batteries, they like the colonel, as I said, once again with the colonel.
So they were using the Bofors against German mortars.
Yeah, it was mostly SP guns, it would be, because they were easier. 55 seconds, they were in action, you know, and ready for use then. And then they used to dig a gun pit and did what they did, and they were out of action and gone, sort of business. So we went one day, there's, I don't know where the gym was, over the other side, the trees. And went out with two troops. During this time, let me, I've jumped a gun, but come about September, I think, infantry was getting that short that they were taking, cut another units down, and they took a troop out of three troops out of 112 Light ECAC, and changed, they got posted to infantry. They'd all had their infantry training. I'd write to somebody who was in the RAF, he got dragged out and went his infantry. So we were down to two troops to a battery then. But anyway, it was two troops used to go. He went there one day, say it was a Monday, whatever day it was, I don't know. We went there to shelter. One half was that end of this great big field, and the other troop was about 500 or 600 yards away down that end. So they did through the OP, firing and things like that, and that was it. It was finished. I was doing drop 200 and repeat, all guns fire, whatever it was. Never, you only said repeat when you wanted. You never say repeat on a radio with RA, with Royal Artillery, unless it was to do with guns firing. If you said repeat your message, it could be misconstrued and things like that. So The first day it was quite good, everything, but it wasn't so successful as you wanted to be, so they were going to go back the next day and do it again. The CO, which was still Colonel Eden, must have been before New Year, the CO who was still Colonel Eden, was going to go up in the Oster aircraft, which he used to use for spotting, and I had to go and operate the radio. He would give me the instructions, pilot do the flying round. I was quite looking forward to it at the time. I thought, it's not a great experience. Anyway, the pilot said, there's not room for three, two in the back cockpit or wherever. So I never looked inside the hostel, I don't know. So the colonel went on his own. And he radioed back to me on the set, and whatever, well, range 600, you know, or whatever the instructions was. And the two troops of guns went back to exactly, oh, they got the gun pit stuff, they went back to exactly the same place. So the colonel that they're flying around, he became airsick, and he was no good at all. The pilot was giving me the instructions from what the colonel was saying. And after they fired the first lot of salvos, the Germans must have had the range of that set of guns up there and fired back. Hit one of the guns. And remember him, I said he was singing When the Lights Go On Again, although he got, that's when he got wounded in the mouth there. So they were out of action up there. So anyway, that finished that. So the next thing it was said, Emery, yes sir, go across and see what's happening over there. Get no answer, couldn't get any answer on her. The radio was damaged, so he couldn't radio back to me. It was well smashed. So I'm driving across this field then, unknown territory with, I was always wearing one earphone on there, one on top. I could always hear what was happening out there. And also looking to see, I wasn't going to drive over any mountains. So I'm driving along this jeep and gets over there. And then I had a radio back because we had another set there. What the trouble was, one gun damaged, two or three injured and all things like that. Which only goes to prove, never go to the same place twice. Because they weren't all that silly, the Germans, not really, no, you know. I sometimes wonder whether, if all things being equal, whether we would have won. with the equipment they had, I'm saying, you know, it was the Air Force. It made a big difference as far as we were concerned. You know, we controlled the air in Normandy and things like that, which made a vast difference to the troops on the ground.
So what's next?
So what's it? I said that there. He shelled there. He was wounded. What else? Where did I go from there? Well, then in January, Colonel Eden went. He went to the 53rd Air Landing Glider Troops Artillery, and going back to we'd. Asked to go in the airborne in 1944. He came back after he'd been gone and gave me asked to see me and said, would I like to go with him back as his wireless operator back to 53rd Airborne? He says, my pal coming, Harry. See, he said, no. He said, Colonel. Oh, the next colonel was Colonel Teacher. He came. He said, no, only one can go. I said, no, I don't want to go, sir. You know, if I can't go with my pal, I'm not going. I could have a chance to come back to England and in train. I'd have most likely got 7 days leave. So I declined that offer. I didn't go with the 53rd. I stayed with 112 Lyakhak.
Now, what was the new colonel, Colonel Teacher like?
Teacher. He was a bit older, I would think. He was a bit quiet then. His batman, his name was Rimmer, Fred Rimmer. I always remember Fred Rimmer. And he always used to whistle silently through his teeth, Beautiful Dreamer. Always, everywhere you go, Beautiful Dreamer. And he always wore a red beret. But he looked after that colonel. You know, he was a good batman, put it that way. Going back to Colonel Eden, when we were at Nijmegen, I had a chance of a second strike there. I was sent for I'm a week away from the OP or the control room up in the tower, and I said, Emery, I'm offering you a second strike. Go away and think about it and let me know tomorrow. I thought, well, right. So I went away and I thought, well, if if I have a second strike, then I shan't be out with the lads, you know, on different jobs. I should be back there over, like, you two go and you two and all. And that didn't really appeal to me. I was quite happy with the out and about and things like that. So I went back next day, come to see Colonel Eden. So Colonel Eden said, went in. Right, Emery, what's your verdict? No, thank you, sir, I don't want it. Oh, he raved and ranted at me. Called me an ignoramus. Well, I didn't know what that was. I thought, well, I didn't know it was a... It was a compliment or an insult. But anyway, he called me an ignoramus. Right, that's it, Emery. Nope, you've had it. So he gave it to somebody else. But I didn't. It didn't really bother me when I was single. I was getting 7 shillings a day. And I couldn't spend it anyway. So anyway, weird, I'd say that radio. I can't remember much about that. Used to do ground shoots around about there, like with the guns. Liquid, a lot of liquid mud about there up over your ankles.
What's next, then?
Well, and then we went back to Belgium for a rest.
Whereabouts did you go?
Tielt. T-I-E-L-T. I've got a woman writing to me from there now, trying to trace her paternal grandfather. Her grandmother had a baby boy, and she's trying to... Anyway, but we went back there to train, and one of the batteries changed from Bofors to Rockets, which they were trained by the Canadians. The Canadians said it'd take them 3 months. They learned in 4 weeks.
When was this? February?
Yeah, about February. I came home on leave from there. They started leave then back to England. So that was roughly about 10 months since I'd been home, 10 or 11. So I was, seeing I was one of the first abroad, I was one of the first regiment to go. One thing I'll say about that, you come back, you came back down to Dover, across that way, Calais, Dover. And you could change your money on the boats. Well, they all knew, whoever the people is, they all knew what, over 6 months, if you 7 shillings a day, what your money, if you hadn't spent any. And you used to get 200 cigarettes a month, duty free, which I didn't have. I used to have the chocolate instead. And we used to get 200 cigarettes a month, free, issued, 450, which I used to save up once a month and send them to my father on a duty-free envelope and the duty-free label, and always arrived, never had them stolen or anything. But on the boat, you could change your French money or Belgian money into English money. But someone there that was at the RSC at different ration depots, they were coming there with hundreds and hundreds of pounds. But they twigged on that, really. You know, if you're on 4 shillings a day for 6 months, how do you get 500 or 600 quid you're trying to change? It's only when he was flogging the rations, somebody else's rations, you know, and things like petrol. It was quite a few core on that. So they'd only let you change so much money. So I came home for 7 days, 7 days leave. Nobody home again, as usual. There was storms in the channel, so the sailings were cancelled. So I had an extra, used to give you sail it like, because movement numbers, ND6, you know, would be come home on the 24th of February and go back on the 3rd of March sort of business. So, but D6 delayed one day, so we had an extra day at home. So I came home on leave. It was nice to be home and all that.
That's still February.
Yeah, yeah, and went back. And then they finished the training there, and it came to the Rhine crossing then. So we moved up then. Advanced headquarters, tactical headquarters, moved up then to just this side of the Rhine. Rather, I developed bronchitis. I had a bark like an Alsatian dog there. The MO used to come up every day and medicine in duty, give me some tablets, but I was sleeping on damp ground, the blankets was damp, you know, and it took me quite some time to get rid of it. They used to say, for Christ's sake, shut up, coughing the Germans are here, all that. That's the sort of sympathy I got there and so on. But we're there, and while they were doing the build up for this Rhine crossing, they used to have drums of old oil that they burnt all along there, so nobody could see anything. Like the Germans couldn't observe what was going on there, but they were coming up, units that had been down on the beachhead ever since the landings. They were bringing them up for the bridge building and what. It was all quite a big doings. So three, I think it was 364 battery had the rockets. 366 battery were going to be ferried across. 112 had the honour, if you like to put it, of having the first gun in the British Army across the Rhine. They went over on, anyway, the rockets, very impressive. They impressed the infantry. Excellent job. They fired salvo after salvo.
What type of rockets were they? Did?
Well, it was, it's barrels. I didn't know my, so many barrels, a bit like a Nebelwerfer, I suppose. But they set off, then they go over in salvos and explode. They reckon it, a salvo then was like about 60 or 80 artillery guns firing, you know. But they all landed over there and impressed the infantry. So they fired that while the Rhine crossing was going on. The infantry was assaulting across. We were on the 15th Scottish Division sector in the Exanten area, the name of the German town, Exanten. And I remember during the morning when it started, watching the RAF coming in with the paratroopers on, and seeing the paratroopers dropping a mile across the river from us, I suppose. And I always remember watching this Dakota coming in, and it was on fire. And it was gradually coming down to crash like that into this wood. And you watch them, and there's all the paratroopers jumping out, trying to get out in time. And he was still jumping out, and it was about 30 feet off the ground, like trying to jump out. But anyway, he went and crashed. But that always impressed me, seeing them trying to jump out and get out in time to, for the parachute to open before it hit the ground. So with the colonel, again, I got a photograph in there. That, we go down to see the guns being ferried across the Rhine on these. It was only a flat raft with a little outboard motor on, and a bloke's I used to drive in. He used to drive the gun on and away across the Rhine. Was pretty wide, mine. It was quite a wide river there, and crossing land the other side. So while I was sat there in the jeep, this war photographer came up talking to me. See, he was taking photographs of this, and he said to me, "Would you like a photograph?" I thought, "Ooh." I said, "Yes, please." I thought, "You're going to take one of me sat in the jeep there." Anyway, he said, "Well, where do you live?" So I gave him my mother's name and address in Bristol. And about 3 weeks, a month later, she had a photograph of showing this gun on the raft just going across the Rhine there. Then going back to Sergeant X again, they eventually got a Bailey Bridge across. We were over, the guns were over the other side. A lot of air bursts about there. Everybody seemed to walk about with their heads stuck down between their shoulders. What difference that made, including me. I was always like this for some reason or other. But we had to lay a line back across this Bailey Bridge, telephone line, I can't remember what for, but we got picked on. So the Sergeant X came with us. So we started off one end to go across. And it was a bit dodgy because there was traffic going across all the time. We're walking along the side, tying off this telephone wire, and looked round. Sergeant X was missing. I don't know where he was. Anyway, we completed the line and went back, and when we got back, there was Sergeant X hiding under the, as the bank come down the Bailey Bridge, when he's hiding under the Bailey Bridge there, away from the airburst. So thought about leading from the front, which sort of didn't please the bloke. So I remember that, and after that then it became a pretty fluid war then, you might say. 112 as a regiment didn't, they sort of followed on and looked after displaced persons, and we went through Munster and Osnabrück round the pass through there, all in ruins. I said, we used to moan about the blitzes here, but Christ, they had a right old hammer in there. Must have been terrible for them, you know. Eventually, we get the Salto.
Anything happened?
No, it was sort of... there was one little episode there where there was a German infantry training, officer training battalion or something, up at this barracks up on the hill, and they wouldn't give in. The infantry and BIPOP, of course, they wanted them take out. They were, so 112 was going to get the job of doing that, but anyway, before they got round to doing it, they sort of saw sense in packed it in and capitulated, or whatever you like to call it. So that was the only thing, really. I remember moving up through What I did see, you go into different villages there, which struck me as mindless. German women must have, very industrious they must have been then, because you go into basements and they'd have jars and jars, all pickled stuff on shelves, fruit, whatever they... But somebody, it's obvious, a lot of places they went in there and they just run their rifle butts along and smashed it all on the floor, you know, which I thought food being what is, and in short, it's, what do they gain by smashing it, you know, it didn't... It might have stopped the German, but anyway, they were gone, they weren't living there, they left, but so they smashed them. And several places I went, it was like that. So we moved up and we went through a place called Salto.
Salto?
Yeah, S-O-L-T-A-U, I think it was, and we stopped there. Only about a Sunday it was. And I remember seeing the Sunday morning, it was German families going to church with their daughters. I should have hated to have been there with a daughter who was about 18 or 20 with what went on. You know, it's... anyway, they were going to church and they said, come and see this. And they went round the back of the cops, by a little railway siding. There was a big trench there, a big pit dug there, and two or three railway trucks there. And they had German women and men digging up the bodies of all these displaced persons, as thin as rakes, their legs were no thicker than my arms, they'd all been shot through the head. But whoever it was there, the troops there, or that the German people around there digging them up and putting them in wooden coffins, plain rough made coffins, and taking away on for burial. But everyone I saw had been shot, that I looked at, had been shot through the head. They all had a head, a hole in there. And we went on from there gradually up to Hamburg, that's where we finished up, Hamburg, May the 8th.
And what do you remember of V Day?
Not a lot, really. We heard the war was over, and there was no celebrations, presume.
Not at all.
Well, you were active service unit, as you know, you couldn't... Do you know what I had somebody say to me, a few years ago now, a woman whose husband was in the army, she used to come to Normandy with us, because we'd been back quite a few times, Peggy and I. She said, did you have fire to go to the pictures at night? You know, and people had no, you know, I'd imagine standing up like, hang on, Fritz, or John Wayne's on tonight down the local, see you in the morning, it's 7 o'clock, sort of busy. That was the only entertainment I had, was seeing George Formby. And I never spoke to any French people, not until that woman said, Mom, brave. I never seen any. You know, I lived like a pig, and it was dead cattle and horses there, seething with flies and maggots, and smelling high, heaven's high, you know. Funny enough, I never seen any dysentery about it. We'd have thought there'd been a lot about like that, you know. They'd only had food out of it, and there'd be a swarm of blue bottles with lovely shiny wings flying everywhere. But no, I never seen, entertainment-wise, nothing, no. That's later on. They did take us to Brussels one day, come back from somewhere, so sort of, take so many from the U.S. So we finished at Hamburg, Altona. That was the other side, out through Hamburg. That was all smashed, people living in cellars, go miles and miles, roads, everything smashed down, just people living in cellars there. But we took over this house. And it used to be evident, it was an English businessman owned it before the war. And there was Russians there that had come from, that the Germans had brought. Okay, they brought from Russia to work for them. So they were in the camp when we got there, about eight of them. We'd also picked up a Russian in Normandy. I don't know, he was supposed to be working on the farm, but anyway, we brought him with us all the way, gave him the quartermaster gave him a battle dress and he used to help do all the menial tasks and cigarettes and all. He was quite happy. And he came all the way with us to Hamburg. Anyway, at Hamburg, the powers that be then had decided that we had to start getting rid of the displaced persons, you know, all them that had come out. It was gradually had to be. So one of our jobs, or the regiment's jobs at Hamburg, right opposite the U-boat pens across the river. You could see all the big U-boat pens with a great big concrete roofs on there. Was to collect all the Russians up and send them on the train back to Russia. Now, all those people there in that, it was organization Todd headquarters before we took it over, area headquarters. All those Russian people there practically got on their hands and knees and pleaded with us. They come to work in England or us for nothing, but don't send them back to Russia. Because Stalin has said all those that worked for the Germans were traitors and they would be treated as such. We found a radio and we'd given it to them. They used to tune into Moscow. They were frightened to death to go back. It was quite hard. And I felt a bit of a heel, but anyway, you'll be bearing orders a week around. The Russian soldier we picked up had been taken prisoner of one of these big pincer movements. And eventually he taught him to speak a bit of English and all that. And he said, "Are you taken prisoner by the Germans?" "Yes," he said. "The planes used to come in, the Russian planes come in, take all the officers and fly them out and leave us there for the Germans to take prisoner." That's what he said to us there. He was he wasn't very complimentary about left all them to. But anyway, he finished up working on this, like what he was saying, on this French farm there, and that's how we picked him up. But so we had to round them all up and take them back down the railhead. During this time, this was, what, June? I suppose the country was bankrupt, and they started then, the mob started. You know, all them that was, I was group 42, age, younger you were, unlucky you were, really. If you were 36 and went in the same day as somebody who was 18, he was 18 points further up the list than what you were, sort of business. But anyway, they started sorting things out and splitting up. 12th Corps got disbanded because it was a TA Corps, then put it that way. Come from Kent, that was their area. And we, 112, like that, got posted from 12th Corps to 3rd Div, the Ironsights, Monty's old division in Dunkirk, wasn't it? But they were a regular division. So we got made up. All the mob groups under 27 got posted at other regiments. They weren't going. And we got posted to 3rd Div in the Strategic Reserve. So we went from there. Again, I was on the advance party. I went with Colonel Teacher. We had to go down to Paderborn, not far from Paderborn. To run a POW camp down there, Stimuli Lager, Senna Lager down around, sort of German Salisbury Plain it was. And we took this camp over, so we had to go down with Colonel Teacher, me, Harry, his batman, and the colonel went down there, and the Americans were running there. Now, you only had to be on the local council of the smallest village, and they arrested you there. Everybody went inside, you know, with people as old as me, they're walking about, arthritis, walking sick. So we got there, and the colonel went off to see the American. They were splitting the zones up there, and that came under the British zone instead of away from the Americans. And while I was there, the colonel come out to get the jeep. There was a party of working party of Germans being marched up the road. I was saying they were all walking with sticks. And they used to make them sing a German marching song. I've heard it on a record not so long ago. It was a marching song. They were all singing this marching. This American, a cruel lot of swans, a lot of Americans walking along with the old swagger behind him. And down by the roadside, there was a cigarette butt on the road. And this old chap bent down to pick it up. And he come along there and he hit him straight in the small of the back with his something like that. So I thought, well, that could be my grandfather, you know. But anyway, Colonel Teacher said, "That's one thing that we shan't be doing when we come here."